of you people have touched real data of any sort? Okay, good. Because this is going to be quite a data-oriented talk, and I will start by showing you what the experimental landscape in cosmology is going to be like in about 10 years' time. And you can see here a list of different kinds of data sets we're going to have. Cosmic microwave background has, of course, been the foundational, cornerstone of precision cosmology. So the idea about this talk is that we now need to move from precision, which is measuring parameters, to greater and greater, smaller and smaller error bars, to accuracy, which is understanding whether we can make robust inferences from the data that we have. And large-scale structure is, I think, where the future is going to be, because there's so many data surveys that are going to come online in the next 10 years or so. And also, we are seeing the birth of 21-centimeter cosmology as well, and gravitational wave astronomy. So the science goals in these future surveys have, they tie the early and late-time universe together, and they're multi-goal. And so the crosstalk of these different data types and probes are critical for the success of this research program. So this is going to bring with us quite a lot of challenges as well. This is going to be the so-called, the buzzword right now is the big data era. So huge data sets, so big that just like in particle physics these days, we might not be able to get human beings to look at all the elements of the data, and we might need intelligent algorithms to tell us, you know, what are the interesting parts of the data that a human being should look at. It also involves small signal to noise. The concordance model of cosmology is currently confirmed to higher and higher precision. However, in the next 10 years, we have to find departures from this standard concordance cosmology, which is a phenomenological model. We need to understand the physics of that model, and that inevitably involves trying to find small signals on top of that concordance cosmology background. So small signal to noise is going to be a feature, and we need to figure out what elements of these data sets are actually physical signals compared to systematics. There's going to be a very large model space, extensions of the standard model of cosmology. We don't really know theoretically how to pick between them in terms of physical intuition, so we need to actually explore very large model space. And cosmic variance comes into play, which we have in cosmology, which is that the single realization of this random cosmological model that we have. And this brings me to this quote: no one trusts a model except the person who wrote it. Everyone trusts a data set except the person who made it. So it is very typical of theoretical physicists to be very skeptical and very inquiring of models, new models that are proposed. However, people seem to just trust data, okay? Except, experimentalists don't, right? And part of this talk is going to be that I want to show you what's under the hood in large-scale structured data analysis. And I want to show you that it is very complicated, and just because some naive analysis of a large-scale structured data set shows an indication of new physics, you should not believe it, and you should be very inquiring of those results. So I'm going to show you some ways in which you can try to understand and mitigate these systematic effects that cloud our physical inferences from this data as well. So astronomy has been, likened to mud wrestling, okay? So I'm going to show you some of the mud and how we wrestle it. And hopefully by the end, you've got some idea of the complexities of large-scale structured data and how we can actually get to physics from looking at such data sets. So here are a few data analysis challenges that come about. So people are very familiar with inferences now from the cosmic microwave background. Even here, we have quite a lot of problems to deal with, such as complex masks, colored noise, inhomogeneous noise that varies across the sky, foregrounds, etc. Large-scale structure brings with it a much greater degree of complexity. I'm going to show you quite a lot of these types of problems that we have to contend with in large-scale structure in coming slides. The thing that we want to emphasize here, that you need a thorough understanding of the data and its systematics for convincing detections of new physics. And I'm going to show you this using a case study from a large-scale structured data set, which is SDSS Quasars. And this is work done in collaboration with my former PhD student, Boris Laistet, who's actually going to the US next year as a fellow, and Nina Roth, who's a postdoc with us at UCL. And the work is summarized in these papers. So the case study I'm going to show you is how to measure primordial non-Gaussianity from quasar surveys. I'm going to show you the problems that arise in both data analysis and theory when trying to measure this effect. And in the end, I'm going to show you some advances that we have made in recent surveys to try to mitigate these kinds of systematic effects that we get. So what are quasar surveys? So quasars, for the purpose of this talk, are bright, highly biased traces of the large-scale structure, and they span very large cosmological volumes. So here is a depiction of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, just a slice through it. And you can see that you can see galaxies are to some redshift, but quasars, you can see, span much greater redshifts. That's because they're very luminous objects, and you can see them much, much further away. So what you're seeing here already, these bands, they are not real in the sense of the cosmological distribution. They are actually selection effects here. So the idea with quasars is that you can probe very, very large volumes, but they're also some of the most biased traces of large-scale structure. Their intrinsic astrophysical bias is very high, and so you can use them as a tracer of primordial non-Gaussianity. I don't need to tell this audience, I think, what is primordial non-Gaussianity, but just to summarize, before Planck, most of the constraints on inflation came from measuring two-point observables. So you would take all the information in this map of the cosmic microwave background, 50 million pixels there, and do a radical data compression of that to get about 2,500 multiples, which summarizes most of the information in that map, all of it if it's completely Gaussian. But now we want to look for physical signatures beyond the two-point correlation function because the higher order correlations could potentially encode quite a lot of information. And primordial non-Gaussianity is one way to do that. For example, if you just parameterize the primordial potential in this way, where you've got this FNL local parameter here, this is a standard way to measure the local form of non-Gaussianity. And measuring that parameter to be much, much greater than one would immediately rule out the textbook picture of inflation. So this has an effect on the growth of fluctuations in large-scale structure through the so-called high-peak bias effect. This is a version of the Kaiser effect, where if you live on top of a very large-scale fluctuation and you are one of these very high sigma fluctuations, you're more likely to be in a large overdensity which collapses sooner. So the enhanced abundance of massive objects in overdense regions leads to an enhanced clustering effect. And because quasars are highly biased traces of the large-scale structure, they tend to show an even more enhanced effect of this so-called scale-dependent bias. So this was proposed in this very nice paper in 2008 by Dalal et al. And this shows the very first attempt to measure this effect from large-scale structures. So what you see here are a whole set of different traces of large-scale structure. Up here, LRGs are luminous red galaxies. So these are like galaxy constraints on this high-peak bias. And you can see the error bars are very, very large, and that's partially because they don't span as large cosmological volume, and also because they're not as biased as quasars. All these things down here, where you can see, you know, smaller error bars, are coming from quasar surveys. And the effect that you measure is actually a two-point effect. So if you have FNL of zero on very large scales on the matter power spectrum, it looks like that, but you get an enhanced bias on very large scales in the halo power spectrum if you've got FNL not equal to zero. So that's just a bit of background to get back to quasars. So what is the potential of quasar surveys for primordial non-Gaussianity? So you can see the scale-dependent bias effect here is a function of wave number and redshift. You've got the FNL prefactor here. This is the astrophysical bias of the tracer that you're using to try to get at this effect. So if this B is high, as for quasars, you're going to get a more enhanced effect here. And also you can see that it grows with an inverse square of the wave number as well. So this is a recent compilation by Giantonio et al., an update of that previous work that I showed you. And again, you can see a whole set of different types of large-scale structure traces. And so that's FNL of zero. And you can see that quasars, again, have the smaller error bar. You can also see this survey, which is a radio survey, which is radio loud quasars and galaxies, showing a very, you know, high significance detection of FNL. And that is the sort of effect that we want to talk about, because that detection is not real. It's coming from systematics. And similarly, you can see that if you naively combine all these data sets here, you get a very high significance detection as well. So we want to try to understand what's behind these kinds of deviations from FNL of zero that's coming from systematics. So for this, we want to use photometric quasars. What are photometric quasars? So the problem with quasars that come from spectroscopic catalogs is that they're small and they're incomplete. For example, this is a sample of spectroscopic survey, quasars from the STS-SDR7 survey, and it's got about 3 quasars per square degree. Here, we've got photometrically selected quasars, and that's got about 15 per square degree. So just the number density means that the Poisson noise, the short noise that you're going to get from making this map into an overdensity map, is much less if you use these photometric quasars. But these are quasar candidates. They're not actually confirmed spectroscopically, okay? So you're going to have some spurious stars in here as well, because quasars look like stars in color space. So part of the problem is that you've got contamination here from stars, and you've also got a whole bunch of other contaminations that I'm gonna show you in a second. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a very good question. Okay, I'll go into some more detail about how you find this, okay? So if you have a spectrum, and you can see the Lyman alpha line, you know the redshift, and you know it's an object that that is a quasar. However, taking spectra is very expensive, okay? So you have to stare at the sky much longer in a given object in order to get a spectrum. So what people do instead is that if you take a whole bunch of spectra and you look at the translation into broadband colors of that spectrum, you see that quasars, as a function of redshift, lives in certain parts of color space, okay? So broadband filters are used to select out possible candidate objects for photometric surveys. Some fraction of them are followed up, but only a very small fraction. So then you have to use some probabilistic algorithm to try to separate whether this is a star, something in our own galaxy, which has similar colors, but we'll have a very different spectrum, but we don't actually know what is whether it's a star or not, because we don't have the capability to take spectra of all these objects. Does that answer your question? SDSS does both, that is true. But the converse is not true, that if you select a whole bunch of photometric quasars, you can't go and take a spectra of all of them, just some fraction. And often it's very inhomogeneous. You can see here that there was a lot of hits in these 3 bits here where they took spectra of a lot of objects in that area. Okay, so it's very inhomogeneous over the sky. Yes? it's systematics limited, as I'm going to show you. Okay. So what I want to show you with this slide is that, first of all, quasars would give you, if you could control the systematics, the best error bars on FNL compared to, say, galaxies or this heavily contaminated radio survey. But as I'll show you in a second, they're plagued by systematics. Here's an example. So if you look at, so this is angular power spectrum of an overdensity map. So these units are just, for the moment, just arbitrary, but the line actually means something. So if you have this black line, that's FNL of zero. The gray band is plus or minus 50. And if you just naively measure quasar spectra, they look like that. Okay? So that would be a very, very high significance detection of FNL, very different from zero, if you were to actually take that seriously. So you have excess clustering power on large scales, and these come from systematics. And so therefore, quite a lot of papers said, looking at these quasar samples, that they were too contaminated for clustering studies. So what are these systematics? So it's anything that affects point sources or colors, seeing or sky brightness or stellar contamination or dust obscuration or calibration. So what I'm showing you here is, so here's the full sky. Usually you see CMB maps where the galaxy is along the plane here, but this is an equatorial projection of the SDSS survey, so the galaxy goes like that. And you can see that close to the galactic plane, there are more stars than further away. That's dust. So this is kind of, you know, most stars cluster near the galactic plane. So that's kind of obvious and a nice pattern. Maybe you could cut that out with a mask. Here's dust. It's much more inhomogeneous. Away from the plane, you can see quite a lot of dust. This is seeing. So this is turbulence in the atmosphere as the telescope tracks across the sky. You can see SDSS is a drift scan survey. So you can see correlated observing conditions as the telescope tracks across. So variable observing conditions. If you look at the SDSS database, you can find 220 possible observational systematics like that. Here's some of them. They're not independent. Some of them are correlated. For example, red stars are correlated with just all stars. You can see that many of these things track the drift scanning of the instrument. And some of them are quite different. For example, sky sigma, which will come out in some other slides later, just means the amount of variation, the variance in the flux of the sky as the telescope scanned across. So you see so many of these systematics. And if you were to come up with a formula to mask the sky that accounts for all of these, then you would throw out most of your data, and your error bars would be huge, OK? So I want to show you a method where you can try to mitigate these systematics and do it in a blind way. So what we don't want to do is to look at the data by eye, think, oh, this data point must be due to a systematic. I come up with a way to cut that data point or down to size, make it closer to FNL of zero. So we don't want to have any human interference in selecting how to take out the effect of these systematics. I'm going to show you two data sets that we use for this. One is the RQ catalog, which is UV excess sources from this Richards et al. Catalog. But the main one is the so-called XDQSOZ, extreme deconvolution. It's just an algorithm that is used to estimate the redshifts and do the star quasar separation from this photometric catalog. So you've got 1.6 million quasar candidates from SDSS Data Release 8. They span quite a wide redshift range, so from 0.5 to 3.5. And you've got 800,000 quasars after basic masking just for the quality cuts of the survey. So the first thing that we want to mention here is that you have to estimate the angular power spectrum of this survey from part of the sky, okay? So you have to estimate from cut sky data the full sky angular clustering. So a typical CMB mask has quite a lot of sky fraction that's been observed. So here's a CMB mask. This is the galactic plane in this plot. That's a W mask. So you can see, you know, the sky fraction that's observed is very high. Large-scale structure masks tend to have very small observed sky fraction. So actually, this is a very important issue to take out this cut-induced variance properly. And to do that, you can have several different kinds of estimators, and the one that I'm going to mention is the so-called quadratic maximum likelihood estimator. And it's optimal, that means it's minimum variance, but it requires a model of the pixel-pixel covariance matrix. So here is the pixel-pixel covariance matrix between pixel I and pixel j. And so you need an estimate for the theory spectrum to compute it, and you've got this noise or systematics or whatever you want to put in it in the estimator. The so-called pseudo-spectrum estimator, PCL, is like QML, but with a diagonal pixel-pixel covariance matrix, a flat power spectrum. Just to show that visually, here is a depiction of the pixel-pixel correlation implied by a QML estimator. So it accounts for the theoretical expectation for how this pixel is correlated with its neighbors. And this one assumes that it's essentially uncorrelated. That's the the PCL estimator. And if the underlying theory spectrum is fairly flat, PCL is almost good enough. Like the gain that you get from going to that is not as high. For the case of the cosmic microwave background, it's not a flat power spectrum. It is very red, especially at very large scales and very small scales. And therefore, that is not a good approximation. However, most large-scale structure spectra are fairly flat. So if you didn't have any systematics, PCL would have been good enough. However, in the presence of systematics, it's not, because this assumption that it's a very close to flat power spectrum is violated. So we want to introduce this idea of mode projection. So basically, we say that PCL is suboptimal with complex masks and systematics, but we want to use QML with mode projection. So this marginalizes over a linear contamination model, which includes systematic templates. So here, just as an illustration, is the RQCAT catalog. Here's a systematics template with stars. That's dust extinction. So there are certain pixel space modes that we want to not use in an intelligent way when we use the estimator. So again, I've suppressed the IJ indices here. So this is the pixel-pixel covariance matrix. That's the theory part. Here's the short noise that goes in here. And we want to mask out the systematic templates, which are indexed by K, by sending the coefficient here to infinity. So basically, you project out certain modes out of the estimator when you're estimating the power spectrum. You don't use some data in an intelligent way. Yes?
So when you say sharp noise, is it just profound noise?
Yeah.
So, if the structures are correlated, don't you expect things that basically bigger than profound noise? Like if all quasars come in pairs, for example, don't you expect to have an enhancement of the sharp noise?
But usually what you do, this is very large scale structure. Sorry, there's this very large angular scale estimates here, right? So what you do typically for this analysis is that you would pixelize the quasars onto the sky, and those pixels are quite big. And then you make an estimate of the Poisson noise by looking at the power spectrum and where it goes to a flat spectrum. So just let me remind you that there are many, many, many of these systematic templates, and they are correlated. So therefore, just naively including all of these systematic templates is going to lead to all of the data all of the systematics being projected out of the data, and quite a lot of data will be lost. Okay, so we want to do this in a more intelligent way. And what we did in this analysis is to create a set of input systematics. And for that, we didn't want to select them out by hand, because that is a kind of non-blind way of doing it. Instead, we took all of these possible 220 systematic templates in the database and products of pairs of them, because just a linear model of this systematics was not sufficient to project out all the relevant modes. So that gives you greater than 20,000 templates. And again, if you naively project out all of those templates in your data, you throw most of the data away. Okay. So instead, what we do is we decorrelate the systematics. By essentially doing an SPD, you find the 3,700 uncorrelated modes that come from these 20,000 systematics templates. Even that is too much. And what we do then is to ignore the modes that are most correlated with the data. Okay? So in this case, we chose to project out modes where if you cross-correlated the data with each of these decorrelated 3,700 modes, and if they had a reduced chi-square greater than 1, we project it out of the estimator. So it's like masking in a rotated basis, an intelligent way. And it sacrifices some signal in favor of robustness. So here are these null tests. Yes? It doesn't, you see, because it's not that we're correcting the spectrum. It's just that we don't use those modes in the power spectrum estimation. Yeah.
And my templates were the individual templates.
Yeah.
If I were to fix in advance, independent of the data rule, mm-hmm. some subset of the Gaussians to drop, then I agree that the senior space power spectrum estimator automatically gives them biases.
Mm-hmm.
But in this sort of toy situation, if you drop only the ones with reduced chi square, with delta chi square greater than 1,
mm-hmm.
you're actually cutting off the tails, which is some operation. The way you're correcting the power spectrum would say that every time you drop a Gaussian, you just reduce the power spectrum by 1. And that's correct if you're fixing in advance the Gaussian you drop, but you just drop the ones that scan.
I'm not sure about that, Kenrick, because let's imagine that rather than masking the galactic plane in CMB analysis, you mask it out in your estimator by sending the noise in those pixels to infinity.
Okay, yeah, so the CMB is a good example. If I mask a subset of the sky, which mm-hmm. is uncorrelated with the CMB,
mm-hmm.
no problem. It's an unmasked estimator, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But if I just chop off the peaks of the CMB, if I say I drop a region of the sky, if its correlation with, if its overlap with the template that picks up the spatial region is large,
mm-hmm.
if I just
Yeah, I mean, we can actually show with simulations that this is an unbiased process, right? Well, I think that it's theoretically unbiased. Yeah, sure, that's fine. So then, so these are the 3,700 null tests that you make, and these are different bins in Redshift. Okay, so if you do cross correlations in this rotated basis of the data with the systematic templates, you can histogram them. So these are different choices for the analysis mask, which I'll show in a second. And you can see that, for example, in the lowest Redshift bin and the highest Redshift bin, there's quite a lot of correlations between the systematics and the data. In these middle two Redshift bins, it's fairly, okay from that point of view. So what you do is basically you take all of the modes that give the reduced chi-square greater than 1, and you project them out of the estimator. So just to reiterate, this is like masking in a rotated basis. So rather than correcting the data, so what's standard in this field, I should say, is that you do this cross-correlation with whatever systematic that you want, and you estimate the cross-correlation, and you actually correct the estimated angular power spectrum, you subtract that part of the cross-correlation from the power spectrum. So we don't want to correct the data. We want to mask in an intelligent way. So then the estimated variance is actually self-consistently inflated by doing that. And it's also a data-driven contamination model in the sense that we didn't pick by hand which systematics we want to consider and which we thought were not important. All of the systematics that are potentially contaminating the data are in this estimator. And finally, it's a blind mitigation. There's only one free parameter in this analysis, and that's where to do this chop. We said that in advance, and we don't touch the analysis pipeline after that. Yes. So there were potentially 3,700 uncorrelated modes, and I don't have the number in my head how many got left after this chop, but you can see that in this plot.
Still, most of them are left, you think? Yeah, so most of them are below password of one.
Not in bin four.
No, right, so in bin, okay, then bin.
Yeah, so look at bin four, right? Okay, in 1 second you will see why bin one and bin four are problematic. So anyway, this is the kind of concept of this analysis. Now I'm going to show you the sky masks. So again, this is the SDSS survey projected in equatorial coordinates. And the part that is being used for the analysis, the basic mask, is the part in blue. And we can use this maximum likelihood estimator to simultaneously get 10 auto and cross angular power spectra for this data set in four redshift bins. And if you just naively did this analysis using a maximum likelihood estimator but not using this mode projection, what you would get are, you know, this is the full set of auto and cross power spectra. And I know it's a complex plot, but what you should focus your eye on is that the black line is the theoretical FNL of zero power spectrum. And the measured power spectra are generally significantly above it. And this is what you get after mode projection. And remember, we haven't actually corrected the data by hand at all. This is a process that has been fixed in advance of doing this analysis. And here is a very prominent example of this. So these are the raw spectra, and these are three basic analysis choices. That's what you get after cleaning the spectra. And you can see the error bars are inflated somewhat, but certainly we are not getting this kind of effect going on here, right? And the gray bands here are plus or minus 50 FNL in this case. So in the interest of time, I'm going to go past quickly the theory part and just show you the problem of spectroscopic and photometric data sets.
So in this 2 points thing with power spectrum,
yeah.
You
can
find, like, lots of things that might be degenerate with FNL.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way, I mean, so presumably with the 2 point alone, there's not a way to separate an effect of FNL from something else, or is there?
What do you mean by something else? You mean systematics?
Well, I mean something like this, you could change like the large scale primordial power or something.
So if you had an alternative model, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
And FNL. Mm-hmm. Are they
completely degenerate
in 2 points? Yeah. So, unless you give me an example, I probably can't say.
No, I don't think they could be degenerate because different things with different bias, I mean, have different effects. Like, bias is one for something,
right.
Then there is no FNL effect.
Are you talking about a primordial effect here? Or?
Yeah, if I just boosted the primordial power.
I see. Right. I suppose that you can always change a primordial power spectrum and come up with something on large scales, but maybe you can compare with, say, CMB power spectrum, right? Because this is the halo power spectrum. And so you would have to somehow come up with something where the primordial modes are not boosted, but somehow the quasar power spectrum is boosted, so I don't think that would make much sense. Sorry, I'm going to skip this because I want to show you some other stuff at the end, but I want to show you this. So this relates to the question that somebody was asking earlier. Here's a quasar power spectrum. These are the SDSS UGRIS filters here. So you can get a very broadband version of this spectrum, and that's essentially the problem of using a photometric sample. So you might think, you know, how good is this estimate of redshift? And it's not good. Okay, so here is the photometric redshift estimate versus the spectroscopic confirmation of those particular set of objects. And if they were good, you would get x equals y. You can see this amazing set of flowers on this plot. So quasar spectra have large fraction of outliers, and the redshift distributions are poorly known. And this impacts the robustness of the theory spectra. So remember that you've got to actually estimate a theory spectrum, which has this line of sight integral here, which has this contribution from the redshift distribution, which is the window function that you integrate over. And to make this prediction that you would compare with this nice set of spectra that we have obtained here, you've got to know the redshift distribution. Okay? And that's very difficult because of the effect that I just showed you. So here is the set of redshift distributions if you make cuts in photometric redshift space. So if you take four photometric redshift bins, which are those lines here, the actual underlying redshifts that come from being in those photometric bins are very wide. And in particular, look at the lowest one and the highest one. You can see that the highest redshift bin has lots of contribution that appear in photometric space to come from low redshifts. And this lowest one has peaks in high redshift, okay? So this is a complicated issue. And in our analysis, yes. This analysis, it comes from the XDQSO Z algorithm. And what they do is they make a data-driven model of the, so it's essentially a hierarchical Bayesian model. They don't call it that, but that's what it is. So they have a source model and a population model, and they perform shrinkage on the individual sources based on the population model that comes from spectroscopic sources. In our previous analysis, we actually did this by cross-matching with spectroscopic catalogs, which is not something that I advocate now. I think the spectroscopic samples are too small. So we can actually add some uncertainty to these N of Z distributions when we do the cosmological analysis. So we vary this N of Z parameters, we vary the cosmology, we vary the quasar bias. Remember, they have astrophysical bias as well. And this, again, is quite unknown. This model comes from fitting quasars up to redshift of 2. It's not been validated at higher redshifts. And so we show here, actually, that it works quite well at high redshift as well. So all of these complexities enter into the computation of the theoretical spectrum that you compare with the data. And in the end, this is what we get. So here's FNL of 0. This gray band is the previous 2013 Planck release. And here's a whole set of analysis choices in comparing the quasar spectra with cosmology. And you can see that the analysis is quite robust. And we do as well as WMAP9 with this data set that you know, people said was too contaminated to use. So that's pretty cool. And compared to previous analyses, here is combination of NVSS, LRG, QSO, et cetera, everything combined giving you these error bars. And in this work, just with quasar only, we get that error bar. And we can also look at higher order terms, GNL. So in the case of GNL, there's a degeneracy in this scale-dependent bias between the contribution of FNL and GNL, because the bias is related in the same way to both parameters. And when we constrain GNL with this sample, we get an error bar which is the best available from large-scale structure. And till last month, it was the best available, period. And this is actually Kendrick's nice work on the Planck FNL paper, where we get a similar constraint from the Planck analysis. Just in the interest of showing you new work related to these kinds of directions, I want to show you the landscape of large-scale structure surveys, you know, that are coming up. So, well, that's the old plot. It says 2014, so we are now here. We're in the second year of observations of the dark energy survey, and you can see that very, very long-term and large photometric surveys are coming. For example, LSST, which I understand PI is involved in. So if you want to, say, take a physical effect such as FNL, and you look at the statistical error bars from these surveys on this quantity, this is the dark energy survey here. And LSST, the prediction is less than delta FNL of 1. Okay. So LSST, you know, one of my favorite surveys, it's started construction now. It's an 8-meter class wide field telescope. It's got a 3.5 degree field of view, a 3.2 gigapixel camera. So it's going to take 30 trillion measurements. So this is this big data era. It's 18,000 square degrees of half the sky. And for this, we made a forecast of what would be the impact of having systematics in this data and how it would degrade your error bars on this particular quantity. So the expected statistical sigma for FNL is less than 1. If you put in a contamination model, of like the one that I was showing you for SDSS, you get a systematic bias of FNL of 30, which is already pretty good, actually, because you saw in the SDSS case, the bias was much, much greater than 30, but still. And correcting this bias would inflate this sigma to about 5, but that's, you know, that's what we can do in a forecast like this. But in a real survey that we actually have data for, we can do better. I'm going to show you some work from the dark energy survey, which is, yes. This is some artist that they hired to make all sorts of artistic impressions of LSST. So if you did, if you took out all the telescope infrastructure, this would be the arrangement of the mirrors. Yeah, and that's the size of a person there, so that's real. That's completely true, I hope. Okay, so this is a... I'm going to show you the dark energy survey, which is a current survey that's in the second year of observations, which me and several other people in UCL are working very hard on. So it's a 4-meter. It's at Blanco in Chile. And it's a 570 megapixel camera. And it's a 2.2 degree field of view. So this is the dark energy camera set of CCDs. So you've got 62 CCDs of this form. And in the case of SDSS, we just had to rely on the SDSS database to map all these systematics. But for this survey, we can do it in real time and do a very, very detailed job of it. So for example, if you've got a single exposure, this is the geometrical projection of a single exposure images, which are co-added in this tile, which is black. You can see the individual pointings here, and so these squares correspond to these CCDs, yeah? So you have to do this projection then onto the sky, and if you do that for different types of systematics, this is the sort of image you get. This is for a single pointing. You have to do this for the whole survey over time for every single data release, of course. So this is seeing, that's a turbulence in the atmosphere. This is sky sigma, which is the variance in flux. And this is the air mass, which is the optical depth through the atmosphere. Okay. So these kinds of systematics get translated from time fluctuations and physical correlations that exist naturally into spatial fluctuations. So this is the problem. So if you do this process for the whole of the science verification data footprint, so the science verification data is about 200 square degrees in the SPT East field and about 50 in the SPT West field. It doesn't matter what these terminologies are. The thing that is interesting is that if you map these systematics, they are not homogeneous across the sky. And that's exactly where these spatial fluctuations arise. So this Lay-Stettetal projection algorithm that we made is now part of the data products in the DES pipeline. And it's being used to investigate the impact on clustering studies and whole sorts of other potential sorts of systematics. You can see how this gets translated spatially. So this is multipole versus CL, again in some arbitrary units. The area of this science verification area is actually quite small. So this black part is just the fluctuations due to the mask. Anything above that is a source of systematics. You can see that seeing and air mass translate into fluctuations at quite high L, but for example, the sky flux translates into excess power across basically the whole wavelength range, multiple range. Okay, so here are scales spanned by fields. These are focal planes, tiles, CCDs, going to smaller and smaller scales. You can already see that these systematics are correlated. So this is the Pearson correlation coefficient for a whole bunch of systematics. And so that's, you know, obviously the x equals y. And you can see some of them are positively correlated, some of them are negatively correlated. So you can get all of these effects out. And what we've done is to incorporate them into end-to-end simulations. So this is familiar to people from the CMB field, but it's very, very new in the large-scale structure area. So you start from, say, an n-body simulation, where you might actually keep the cosmology blind. You make a galaxy catalog, a mock galaxy catalog, based on that n-body simulation. And what's new here is that all the observational effects are now projected through this galaxy catalog onto the sky as images. So you have a mock survey, which has all the observational systematics in it of the real survey, yeah? And then you can give it to your cosmology analysis people and say, recover the original cosmology, which you keep blind. And they can do all the tests you're doing with the data on these simulations. So this is very exciting. This is the so-called blind cosmology challenge UFIG catalog. And so this is the initial incorporation of systematics into this catalog for the SV area. You can see it's not as high resolution as these actual systematics, but it's getting there. And so that's the end. So I showed you an analysis of the XTQSOZ catalog, where the expected statistical uncertainty was about sigma FNL of 10 or 15. It's a huge systematic bias, and it's corrected by mode projection at the cost of inflating this error bar to a sigma FNL of 20 to 25. I showed you an LSST forecast, which showed that if you don't mitigate the systematics, you're going to get a huge bias, which you can actually mitigate and get a slightly inflated error bar. So actual survey systematics can be mapped and mitigated more optimally than what I've shown you here. An industrial scale version of this is implemented in the Dark Energy Survey pipeline currently. It's going to be an official data product. And the end-to-end simulations of survey systematic transfer function should include systematics, and it's currently being implemented in Dark Energy Survey. All the systematics templates I showed you can be downloaded from this website. Thanks very much.
My 2015 result for FNL is 2.7 plus or minus 5.8. Is it Are there reasons why we shouldn't believe that number?
I don't think so. I think that's a very robust number. I should say that the reason I showed you FNL as part of this talk is not because I think that Planck number is wrong, but because it provides a very good example of what you would get from a large-scale structure survey if you didn't take into account the systematics.
Do you expect all of this to agree with Planck definition?
I think it already does in our analysis. So, with large errors, yeah. That's absolutely true. I think that if you naively took the statistical error bars from large-scale structure surveys, in principle, it is possible to do much better than Planck. On the other hand, there are many other cosmological analyses that are taking place right now, which require clustering analysis. A current really hot topic, for example, is tests of modified gravity. Right. If you didn't take into account these spatial variations of systematics, you would get spurious signals disproving, Einstein gravity, for example. So the lesson here is not that you should not believe Planck's FNL number, but rather that if you don't account for this kind of mud wrestling things that you have to do, and which people are working very hard on at the moment, you would get spurious cosmological inferences, which are completely wrong. Yes.
So the method, if I understand it correctly, essentially relies on having a bunch of templates, and you've thrown a lot of templates into the machine.
Yeah.
But what if, there's two scenarios that I would worry about. One, that your templates aren't perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Schlegel's E of V minus V, some representation of the E of V minus V itself is not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Very good question. Yeah. So I would say two things. I would say is Schlegel's E B minus V is not perfect, especially because it's a very coarse map compared to large-scale structure surveys. The resolution of CMB surveys, even with Planck, it's 5 arc minutes. Okay. If we want to correct dust along every line of sight to every galaxy, you need a finer version of that in principle. So these templates are imperfect at some level. So if I show you the one that we are making for the dark energy survey, right? So these data are taken in a time stream by the telescope as it's making the observation. So for every pointing, the telescope records what is the sky flux, what is the variance, there's a whole bunch of things it records. And that's what goes into here. So even if it's imperfect at some level, that is the best representation and understanding of data that we have. And the reason that we want to throw all of that information into this machinery is that if you only look for a certain number of systematics and only correct for those, you risk biasing yourself because there's a selection that you made. And so I think a data-driven model is much, much better than that because it contains all the information you could potentially want to use.
I understand that. I just don't know how you quantify the residual error, right?
You can quantify the
small scale issue in the Schlegel case.
Yeah.
The RV parameter could vary conceivably with different types of dust at different, galactic locations, for example, right? Because of the grain size. So that would change the relative extinction in different planets, for example. Maybe in some unknown way.
Okay.
So there could always be some.
Well, I would say this is the answer to that, because these are all the systematics we know about. We do these end-to-end simulations. So some here's an example. An analysis we're doing right now is to test the accuracy of photometric redshifts in DES. So there are 15 different algorithms that estimate photometric redshifts from galaxies using the DES filters. With this blind cosmology challenge, we know all of the redshifts that are actually in that simulation, okay? We don't reveal that to the analysts. They run their photometric redshift code on that, and they come up with the residual, N of Zs, and then you compare them with the actual ones. So if there was some effect that was there in the data but was not there in these simulations, we would actually see that when we compare the data redshift distributions to the simulation redshift distributions. In fact, that analysis has already been done, and it has shown that some of these algorithms, which are based on templates, make estimates which are narrower than the data. And it has also shown that some other types of estimates based on neural nets have a large fraction of outliers in the simulations compared to the data. So you can actually get at the unknown unknowns, which is what you're worried about, by doing that kind of analysis. But you know, we can't do controlled experiments in cosmology. We just have to do the best we can. And this is much, much better than what's been done now. It's the teapot in orbit around Mars problem. Yes.
Can I have one sort of informally closed question?
Yeah.
I know that everyone who's tried to do this Sloan photometric cluster analysis has had a really heroic struggle. But recently we say DRA and XDQS. Then there was this really paper by Slowstar et al. That used DR6 and they didn't seem to have much trouble. They did just some really simple
math. Yeah, that was the plot that I showed you right at the start. You asked me this question before, Kendrick. And now you're going to make me say it on camera, aren't you? So this is the analysis you're referring to, I assume.
Yeah.
So, well, first of all, they have much bigger error bars. But also, this was based on not even the Richards et al. RQCAT, but a previous version. It's not actually public. So this analysis is not reproducible. I don't mean that they did something wrong, but the data is not there, so that, for example, we could churn it through our algorithm and actually get, it's kind of a homemade catalog. And in the paper, it's not described well enough to reconstruct that catalog. I would say that RQCAT is a much, much better catalog than this. And XDQSOZ is much, much better than RQCAT. So they didn't seem to have some problems, but that doesn't mean to say that they didn't have some problems, in my opinion. It's at very large scales. So it has to be some kind of a course. Yeah. Yeah, it has to be something that's imprinted outside the horizon, and then the local objects know about it because of the Kaiser effect. I think, again, you know, if it's a theoretical unknown, you can never say that you've ruled out all the other possibilities that might mimic FNL in spirit of your question. So I would say that for this analysis, we just take at face value that any scale-dependent halo bias come from FNL.